It Takes Three, baby! In honor of Challengers in theaters this weekend, what was cinema's previous best thruple energy?
I'm Katie Rich, and in the immortal words of Liza Minnelli and Michael York, screw Maximilian! I do. So do I.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm going to have to go with Eddie and Venom and Michelle Williams. That was more Cookie Monster.
That was very Cookie Monster.
Hey, cookies! Elmo! Big Bird!
Have you heard more Cookie Monster than Venom in the past, like, year and a half? I'm guessing, yes.
Probably, yes.
Hello, Eddie. I want the cookies.
It's me, David the Seven, and back when I was starting college, we had incest thruples with Michael Pitt, Ava Green, and Louis, what was his name?
Boy.
The guy that was then in Little Women, that, you know, eventually...
I'm glad you had a chance
on
Women. You had the chance to look this up.
It looks like I did, and then deleted it out of the notes. So great job, me. Anyway, I think I even only saw the R-rated version of that, though. So maybe I could go
back. That's a shame.
Is a shame. 2003, 2004.
You were in
such
college.
An
it was supposed to be the privilege of not being in your parents' house that you could go see the R-rated version of that.
I could watch.
I mean, also the irony of not remembering something movie-related when talking about the Dreamers, given that they would punish you by like having to drink cum or something. That's the game they play. I am David Ehrlich, and I am going to, I guess, go the most sincere route I can for this answer and cite Ernst Lubitsch's Design for Living, which is a movie that I think casts a long shadow over Challengers. I referenced it in my review, a very similar dynamic, albeit in 1933 terms and with less tennis, but twice as much Zendaya somehow. Just kidding.
I saw the movie in college. I should rewatch it. I don't remember it all that well.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 472. It is the week of Wednesday, April 24th. Somehow we know the exact day that in 1184 BC, the Greeks entered Troy using the Trojan horse.
Mm-hmm. I Googled this and I found Wednesday, April 24th. So April 24th, 1184 BC.
Shout out to the Trojans for giving me one of the most useful metaphors in human history.
Yeah, sure. All of us, not just you.
They did it for me. They scrawled my name into the side of the horse. They're like, this is for David. One day.
This is bizarre. Earlier this week, on a whim, I watched Troy.
Yeah, I saw that in your letterboxed.
And
wow.
No, because I discovered that
Apple
TV Plus now has...
That is bizarre enough unto itself that any human would watch a fucking movie by choice.
Honestly, I don't disagree with you. Like, who has
Troy
recently?
Apple has, like, library movies now?
It does. This was another discovery that they now have licensed a bunch of movies. The only place you can stream Troy is Apple TV Plus.
They were like, $5, go. I don't care. No one cares what happens in streaming.
I can see how you
movie.
Get there with like Lee Pace chiseled ass in what's that Apple TV show?
Foundation.
And then you get to Brad Pitt's chiseled ass in Troy. They have a whole chiseled ass collection on Apple TV Plus.
Who plays Brad Pitt's like historically rumored boyfriend, but not in the movie? It's like somebody who's famous now, right?
Absolutely. It's Garrett Hedlund from Tron Legacy. I was trying to pull the Tron line. Hey, kid. Lost track of time
in the Trojan War.
Lost track of his name from Troy.
How does Troy hold up?
Incredibly boring movie.
Incredibly
boring. Wolfgang Peterson, but Eric Bana, so good.
Eric Bana is really
pretty,
good in Troy. I remember that.
Flamboyantly good and silly.
Diane Kruger, most beautiful woman in history.
It's just that nothing happened. It's really
why take the gods out of that story is my question.
Why take the gods out? I guess to make it more realistic.
Wait, doesn't like Julie Christie play a god? Or like, she's not a god
anymore?
She's
Achilles' mother.
But they don't make her a god?
No, the closest they come to having gods in the movies are like, there's a raven has flown over. Apollo smiles upon us. Not as exciting as fucking like Zeus coming down and throwing lightning bolts.
It's true. Troy reboot. Let's do it.
Let's go.
Sure.
Big horse.
Yeah. Maybe we need a Troy reboot. It's, you know, the Aeneid's good.
Yeah, I feel like some good storytelling has come from that. Maybe there's some rich IP to be drawn there. So it appears that we do not have reviews on the app per se. It feels like we haven't done this podcast in like 3 weeks. I don't know if it's just me. Somehow no reviews in that time, but I'm told there are emails.
There are. Our first one, the subject is Traitors at Wesleyan. And the body is this. Hi, Fitwear Gang. I have been a fan for a while now. Not only were you guys the catalyst for a month-long addiction to Marvel Snap, this podcast also introduced me to The Traitors, a show I've now been obsessed with for about a year. I'm a film student at Wesleyan. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
And I decided to host and film my own condensed version of The Traitors. The event I hosted on 420, a campus holiday at Wesleyan,
seems to Zucker Harris Day, I believe is the local terminology for it,
seems to have gone well, although I have yet to watch, let alone edit the footage. Thought you might want to know that this podcast has helped inspire someone to subject 12 college students, many of whom were incredibly stoned, to an elaborate social experiment. Love the pod, Jacob. We made Traitors really at Wesleyan, guys. We did it.
Jacob can write back, and we don't have to read on the show. I just want to know what dorm he's in. I just want to be able to really picture the scene perfectly.
He should also write back if he puts that online somewhere.
That's also true. I would also watch that.
I've watched more hours of worse shit than Traitors at Wesleyan on 420. This next email, the subject is Pirating Down Under, and the body reads this. With all this talk about pirating various forms of media, it got me thinking about the times I had to pirate a show because I wanted to keep up with the chatter of particular shows. Looking at you, Game of Thrones, when my only choice was to pay for an overpriced service owned by Murdoch, and since I didn't want to support that monstrosity, I embraced my convict heritage and turned to pirating. This is Pirating Down Under, as they're from Australia. Also, many movies with limited releases would never make it to Australia, so my only option would be to pirate them. Further back in the 90s, 2000s, releases of movies and TV shows would take 6 months to a year to come to Australia, unless the show did well in the States and the TV networks would make sure it was simulcast. Lost was such a show. I finally remember going to watch the various sci-fi shows at clubs tucked away in media room at a university, which had an underground railroad to gain copies of the latest episodes so we wouldn't fall behind and could participate in the fan chat rooms. So I'll side with Dave on the pirating front. I would also like to say congrats to Katie on getting a new writing job, David for getting into Marvel Snap leaderboards, and Matt for becoming a theater daddy, and Dave for bringing back the SpongeBob remix interlude. Thank you for noticing. I also just watched, for the first time, Doctor Strangelove, and I smiled when the sound bites from the podcast appeared, and I enjoyed watching the movie, but was rather confused about how the movie ended. Warpstone.
I will say this, talk about pirating television just reminds me of the way that I watched a lot of television while I was in college. I'm thinking particularly of Spaced, like, which existed a long time before, but like that was where I like watched it on some guy's laptop on somebody's bed in a dorm.
Ooh,
and when I remember that, I can't.
Where else were you gonna sit?
There were no seats in dorm rooms. And when I realized, like, when I think about that, I realize what a miracle the streaming age is, that there are just things that you can find on a streaming service. Like, streaming has its problems. We've all discussed this, but the hoops that we jumped through to watch British television in the early 2000s, we really put our effort in there. People who loved Doctor Who had to like kill themselves to be Doctor Who fans. Mm-hmm. It was insane.
Thank God for the vertical 480 pixel versions of all of the South Park I brought to college with me. Because I was definitely the dude with this computer.
How many quick time files did you have on your zip drive?
So many. You can leave us an app review on the Apple podcast app. We will read that. We love your 5-star reviews especially. Or you can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. If we don't have either of those 1 week, we get to talk about things like Marvel Snap or, you know, other things that might get you, might inspire you to run reality show games on high college students. So beware. It's the dream.
Kick off the show today, we're going to talk about one of the most highly anticipated sequels
ever
of the year.
I would say ever.
You're right. Well, this year, ever. Many years, decades of all time. It's called Rebel Moon Part 2. The Scar Giver. Yes, the Scar Giver is back. Who did she? She gave
the Scar Giver was here before.
Cora is her name. She's an Imperium soldier, I believe. Who did she give a scar to, David? Was that Atticus Noble, the admiral of the Imperium?
And I just got Sarius's like, right-hand severe man? Indigestion listening to you talking. I can't tell if it's from the chicken teriyaki that I just wolfed down before we started recording, or if it's just from
about
hearing,
the mother world.
Hearing you talk about the Scar Giver. The
Why
mother
are
world,
we not talking
Imperium.
About the mother world? I feel like
what
I could
do we
make
talk
up,
about when we
I could
talk
make
about
up
the
whole whole sentences and they would sound like they're from the Scar Giver. Like, my understanding is it's like they're really reaping what they're sowing on this dust planet as seven quote-unquote samurai come together for
like
the final standoff that was promised to us in Rebel Moon the first
one. It's wild.
It's
wild
doing
that
a
they
1930s
hired Anthony
newsreel?
Hopkins. So yeah. You know, that would have been a really
interesting
Republic
show. City Dispatch voice here. It's a little Easter egg. For
see here, kids. Here's what's happening over here on the planet.
You
what
guys
the fuck
are listening to our podcast we did for years.
I saw two TV shows. I saw Legend of Korra and I saw season 4 of The Simpsons and all my cultural references.
The Veldt. The Veldt. And here we are on the belt.
Here we are on the
Dreadnought is coming over any day. See, kids? Is your daddy home?
They should have made this take place in a science fiction 1930s or something. That would have given it any amount of personality or character. But to backtrack just a little bit here, if you are not familiar with The Scar Giver, we're talking about Zack Snyder's latest film. It's a part two. It's a sequel. This was a 1-2 punch from him. The first one came out in December. I believe that's called A Child of Fire or something. I'm not
the
sure.
Child of Fire? The, child
no,
of
I think
fire?
It's A Child of Fire. So there's more Children of Fire out there to be discovered in part threes and part four. But yeah, this movie is more fascinating to talk about in the context of like what is Netflix doing than it is as a movie as a whole. I think we even discussed a bit of part one back in December when it came out. David, you and I have both seen this film. I think we knew what we were getting into.
Yeah, I saw you at the support group that we had last weekend.
Where we were all inevitably preparing to see the Scar Giver. We had to watch the Scar Giver. This is not so much a part two as like the final act of part one, which just kind of ended. And as Dave, you alluded to, this is kind of a Seven Samurai type movie where in the first film, Cora, played by Sophia Boutella, has decided she's kind of adopted by this farm planet. Their main resource is Malikian wheat, specifically the kind of wheat that you brush your hand against as
Wait,
the sun
is
setting.
Wait, is it called Malikian wheat?
No,
okay.
It is not. But I'm glad that this movie has so much jargon that you could believe.
I got no context whatsoever for this. Actually, wait, I have a question before you start getting into details. Like,
okay.
Is it all just Star Wars-y? Is like,
yeah.
Is there kind of like a one-to-one like Star Wars?
Nothing, okay. I have to say, nothing has ever made me appreciate what the genius of George Lucas and what he was able to create than watching Zack Snyder try to invent a sci-fi universe from whole cloth. I mean, this is someone... Again, I don't know how deep we want to get into the merits or lack thereof of this particular project, rather than talking about Netflix's approach to blockbusters. But we're talking about somebody who built his career out of adaptation and transposition. It started with remaking Dawn of the Dead, and then it was more about just like animating panels of comic books for a while. And he was on that road, and his pivot into original films only started in the Netflix era. And was Owls of Ghul original?
Oh, no, that Sucker was based Punch, on David.
Sucker Punch, of course. Punch. And Sucker Punch being both the closest relative to what he's doing now, but also casting a really unflattering light on Rebel Moon, because even Sucker Punch is that much stronger in every conceivable facet. Watching him try and to do this pastiche of sci-fi tropes and authoritarian imagery and wheat. I mean, I will never get over the fact that in the far future, and I understand it's like a retro-futuristic thing and sort of what Star Wars is going for, where they have light speed travel and laser guns, but also they all fucking like...
If you're on a planet that's good for farming,
but,
farm wheat.
No, but like the fact that the fucking Imperium from the Mother World is going on this Titanic-sized dreadnought that can jump through wormholes. And they still desperately need wheat because Zack Snyder couldn't think to change that one facet from Seven Samurai, which takes place in 16th century Japan, is just so hilarious to me. There is not a single, I mean, there are like random background alien creatures in this.
There are in the first movie.
No, not in the second movie. There are some in here too. I mean, obviously this is a much more concentrated film because
this movie is suffocating. Somehow this is far, far worse than the first film.
When the Imperium pour out of the ship, you can see randos behind them. It all feels like fucking RC Cola. But worse, I'm sure RC Cola is. I haven't had a Coke in 20 years. I'm sure RC Cola is fine. But you know what I mean. I don't know if it's worse than the first one. It's certainly more inexplicable than the first one. I mean, the first one was like truly pulling my hair out. Like, what the fuck am I watching? How is.
Yeah, but at least we're going to like different planets and meeting different characters and it's all nonsense. And it's so surface level, but at least it's like different places and different sites. And this is all on the wheat planet and the battle.
What I'm saying is like this should have been the easy part, right? Like this
should have been the layup.
This is the layup, exactly. I mean, like he spends all this time just
do a big war,
creating the stakes for the battle, creating the conditions for it. And this movie should have just been 2 hours of people fighting. And I suppose I'm glad that it wasn't because the 30 minutes of action that we see is like so fucking
awful.
It's
amazing.
It's true. There's not like a single interesting setup or a bit of action that happens.
Why isn't there a good shot in this movie? I mean, it's because Zack Snyder is also the DP now for some reason.
But at the same time,
really?
Yes.
Just needs that extra money, I guess.
We needed all the characters to go around a table and deliver their identical backstory in the span
identical
of a single scene.
Identical backstories. They've all stood in front of explosions at some point in their past.
Explosions caused by the same people that killed the same people. I mean, and they just go one by one. And I just
the
like
same story.
I mean, it's such first draft nonsense. Is no one at Netflix giving a note?
You're leading into the thing, which is we don't have to belabor the fact that Rebel Moon sucks ass. But Rebel Moon was also intended to be the Star Wars for Netflix, or that's my understanding that we're gonna bring Zack Snyder in. He pitched this to Lucasfilm, or he wanted to make a Star Wars thing. It wasn't gonna happen, but he could do his version. He could do two versions. There's a PG-13 version which we've gotten. There's R-rated cuts somewhere waiting in the wings that
obviously cannot be overstated how much glomming onto the pre-existing Star Wars world would have helped Zack Snyder in this circumstance.
Yeah, because at least he's succeeded at his his highest with remixing other people, and this is photocopying other people, but this was still the big play. This is millions and millions and millions invested in this. There is a video game that Netflix has already made that will come out at some point because they do video games now. There was supposed to be a tabletop RPG. There's comic books that only Ray Fisher, who is kind of in the movie, tweets about. I've seen.
Ray Fisher's back. I'm so glad.
Oh, A greater than B. there is like a lot to this play, and it is dead in the water. And I'm just so fascinated by like what you all make of Netflix as a blockbuster machine. If people don't follow the kind of like trade news, they've recently replaced the person running film there. They've kicked out the old regime who've been there for years and years now, and a new guy, Dan Lin, who produced like the Lego movie and a lot of honestly just like hacky blockbuster shit, has stepped in to kind of overhaul Netflix film. And by all accounts so far, the approach is going to be like really hone the vision and maybe make smaller movies, more genre plays, more of what accidentally takes off, it seems like, at Netflix than the next Red Notice or The Gray Man or Rebel Moon Part 1 and 2. But I guess I'm wondering, like, what is Netflix film at this point? Did they ever figure it out accidentally?
That's a much bigger conversation. I mean, I think it's probably most helpful for the segment that we limit it just to their approach to blockbusters because, as you were talking about the new regime over there, I mean, the jury's still out. I've been hearing for years, particularly from, the awards team, that Netflix's bid for Oscar glory was sort of being phased out of the company, that we weren't going to be seeing the Maestros and the Killers and the Power of the Dogs on an annual basis. And in the case of Maestro, it's fine by me, but for the rest of them, disappointing that they aren't trying to put their money behind making great films. Are great films the same as the films that are in the awards conversation? No, but Netflix, more than any other studio, needs an incentive to make good movies. And that was the best one that they had. So it's unclear what they are going to be doing. There have been sort of conflicting reports. Netflix internally says, you know, they are committed to making great content that their subscribers are going to love, and, you know, fucking movie theaters however they can, and just trying to make people addicted to Netflix at all costs. And you would think that making good movies would be an effective way of doing that. But, you know, is a good movie the same thing as something that's going to get people to watch? When you look at what's on the top 10 of Netflix's streaming charts at any given time, I mean, it's a lot of dog shit, a lot of old dog shit in particular. The algorithm has just picked up and it's become sort of like the viral, you know, Tempest in a Teapot situation. I don't know what's happening, but yeah, I don't know if that is the recipe for good content. I think, you know, chasing subscribers with the data the way they do is probably anti-art. And if the data leads them away from making what most of us would think of as good movies, I think that that is where they will go. And I think that streaming conversation, VC, and all these things further distance us from the idea that art isn't necessarily just product, that it shouldn't be. I mean, the way that we game movies and box office and gross and all the shit, that we need to go back to a time when the movies were healthy, where studios were making things that didn't have the expectation of making a fortune.
When a star giver meant.
Exactly. So, I don't think that Scar Giver is indicative of where, or Rebel Moon as a whole, and the four more movies that Zack Snyder is apparently still in the impression that they're going to make.
It's the number two movie on Netflix right now.
Yeah, pay attention to the headlines over the next couple of weeks, because if it holds interest, and I don't suspect that it will, but doesn't have the vibe that, you know, we'll talk about Baby Reindeer at some point, maybe this episode, I can't remember, but like that's something that you see people talking about. It doesn't seem to be the same case with Rebel Moon.
Well, I've spent a bunch of time on the Zack Snyder Reddit. Last week. Because Reddit is now algorithmically serving me that. Maybe I guess from other places that I go. I don't know what that says about me. But even the Snyder bros, even the people who are hardcore, spent years of their life campaigning to get the Snyder cut of Justice League released, seem very down on Rebel Moon and don't understand it. Apparently, a lot more people talk about Larry Fong, DP Larry Fong, these days than I would have ever expected. But I think he might have been the secret sauce for.
He's the guy who Zack Snyder replaced by being his own DP.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, David, your point, like, is this. I guess I'm wondering if this is the end of a certain era. But I'm also looking back and wondering, like, what were Netflix's. Did Netflix have a hit blockbuster at any point? Did they, like, hit the mark? I mean, they missed it with Gray Man, they missed it horribly with Red Notice. I don't know where they go completely wrong here, and maybe it's just like no notes, give tons of money.
I mean, they made more Red Notices because
they
claimed, and now this data is publicly available. I mean, you can see the view hours, you know, whatever worth it is to you, that people spent wasting away their precious time on this mortal coil watching Red Notice, and we'll do again with Red Notice 2 and 3, whatever the fuck. I mean, they certainly never made a blockbuster size film that mattered,
when we're talking about so blockbuster size has to be like as expensive.
All Quiet on the Western Front count.
That did pretty well.
It did fine, but I don't think that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about Red Notice. We're talking about The Gray Man. We're talking about a Zack Snyder movie,
a movie that would come out on July 4th in theaters.
Right. I mean, the kind of movie that doesn't seem to make sense premiering anywhere but a movie theater. And Netflix, you know, in their omnivorous, you know, lust to control every facet of the film space, decided they need to make those movies too. And I am not
what
convinced that they
have
brought anyone
up?
Any joy. I mean, absolutely awful film.
Yeah, but like, did people watch it?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
despite
definitely.
Its star power.
What? I thought a lot of people talked about that one.
I mean, it talked about it because it was part of the Oscar conversation.
Right there around Hollywood.
But did people care about it as much as like any given Adam Sandler original movie that he's
certainly
made?
Not in a way that saturates into the culture. No.
Nothing's Hubie Halloween.
According to Wikipedia, Red Notice is the most watched by hours of any Netflix original, but I just find that impossible to believe. Bird Box is like third on the list. Way more people talk about Bird Box.
Bird Box was absolutely huge because it hit during the pandemic. I think they had that one in the camp.
Bird Box opened December 21st, 2018, my friend.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
We just liked Bird Box.
No, so the Bird Box experiment was interesting because I think it was the first time where they really spammed their own service. So they didn't used to just have like a highlight box of here's what to watch. It was just your menu. And then suddenly they were like, what if we put Bird Box in front of every single Netflix user? They made it a blockbuster moment.
I mean, they
changing the entire platform.
Right. They can game the system and sort of, you know, to an extent anyway, engineer the kind of success that they want, the narratives they want around their own product.
What's a pretty good Netflix blockbuster that came out and it was watched by a lot of people? The Old Guard. Good, very bad movie. Oh my god.
The worst thing Gina Prince Bythewood has ever made by
Were
a long
you
shot.
In
I know
a good place
a
in July 2020 and therefore immune and to yet, his active charms?
And I wasn't, and yet watching that movie and hating it as much as I did made me realize because of where I was mentally at the time. No, just like how bad it must have been that I was so desperate for joy.
I like the Old Guard a lot.
But
good movie.
Yeah, yep. I'm dreading the sequels. I have been terrified ever since of the little note at the end about how the villain was trapped to drown over and over and over again for eternity at the bottom of the ocean. That really got under my skin. But
don't like it.
Not a very good movie. And if that's the bar that we're holding the rest of Netflix to, it's pretty dire. But I'd be curious to see what the strategy is from here. I think they probably are better off with less costly endeavors that have higher upside. And I imagine that the movies they make will bear that out. But we shall see. When Rebel Moon 3 comes out.
Katie, I just want to let you know, The Scargiver doesn't really have a great ending. It does tee up Rebel Moon Part 3 very directly.
Not only does it tee up
someone out there and Anthony Hopkins' robot with antlers.
Not only does it tee up Rebel Moon Part 3, it suggests that we're really just sort of at the end of the Midgar section of the Final Fantasy VII of the Red Rebel Moon world. That we are just exiting the prologue.
I definitely get it.
It is wild. The disconnect between the ambition involved and the imagination poured into the project is unlike anything I've ever seen.
Rebel Moon. It's the beginning or end of something.
Great. Hot take. As foretold by Dave Gonzalez on this very podcast, there was another Bluey episode called Surprise.
Yay!
It came as a surprise last weekend. As I told Dave, he was the first person I thought of when I got the press release and an excited text from my sister I think I texted her because I got the press release. But anyway, everyone was watching Great Bluey story. Once again last Sunday.
Everyone was watching Bluey.
And then by about 8:30 in the morning, once again, everyone was surprisingly weeping because of a big old time jump. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert for Bluey. That happens at the end. It's so similar to Orion in the Dark, which we talked about a couple months ago, to the point that it happens on the front porch of a house. Did anyone else think about this as they were watching Bluey?
I've never thought of that movie again, but thank you.
There you go.
Netflix
so
blockbuster.
At the end of that episode of Bluey, it basically jumps forward into the future where you meet the adult Bluey arriving to go back and visit her parents who still live in the same house. And there's a cute little joke about the sign episode, which we talked about last week, about how they almost sold it. And then you see the reveal of a little puppy who is continuing the bit that Bluey had been doing earlier in the episode, trying to ambush Bandit, who is now the grandfather and is being suffering all the indignities that he suffered as a father.
What a great toy, by the way, that these kids have. It's a helmet and an endless ball gun.
Yeah,
No
one's allowed to have that.
I'm sure Rob Patches would have loved to give you that as well.
My take on this comes courtesy of Facebook groups that I am not part of, but keep getting fed to me on Facebook. Do any of you guys open Facebook enough to have encountered this?
No.
I don't know my Facebook password anymore. Someone tried to hack into it over the weekend. Best of luck to them.
Post on Bluey boards.
I mean, a couple of local parent Facebook groups, which I find very useful for all the like general, like where can I find a trampoline park reasons. And then also a couple of buy, sell, trade clothing groups that function better on Facebook than anywhere else. My kind of hot take within a hot take is that Facebook might be the best remaining social media platform, because if you have a Facebook group that is functional and useful, it is the most practical, useful social media I have by far for like selling stuff I don't want, buying stuff that I actually want.
You know,
getting
you can
advice.
Just start your own website and forum and get off these social media platforms and build something useful for yourself.
I don't really want to start a website that's about like parenting advice locally. I just want like to go on Facebook and like be like, hey, who wants these books? And then someone takes these books. So the downside of this is that Facebook is constantly giving me like showing me like, here's a group you might be interested in. And I'm pulling it up right now to see what they're trying to feed me right now. There's like home design and decor, where it's like people asking like how they should decorate their like weird fireplace in their McMansions. I'm kind of endlessly fascinated by like just people's weird lives that get revealed by these groups. And one of the groups that keeps getting fed to me is adult Bluey fans. Dave, I know you're not in it, but you know, some of them might be your people.
Oh yeah.
And these people, the minute that surprise came up, could not stop speculating about who the father of Bluey's baby would be.
What? Come
and
on!
I need these people to chill the fuck out. Stop doing this. You can't, like, do not speculate about the father of Bluey's baby. Who cares?
Well, first off,
it's probably not Mackenzie or Jean-Luc. I just want to be clear about this. It's probably someone that Bluey doesn't know when she's 7 years old.
Are you trying to say that Bluey got around?
And listen, those are the two most popular theories. People are trying to compare, like, they like sketch Mackenzie, and then they sketch this kid you see for a second. They're like, here's all the similarities, and then these people need to stop. That's my hot take.
Very heteronormative for them to believe that Bluey is in a heterosexual.
It just implies that, in this picture. That show creator Joe Brum and his writing staff sat around sort of hashing out who Bluey might have fucked in this scenario, rather than just being like, what if the dog looks like this?
I sincerely hope that they thought not at all about this, and the weirdos on Facebook are the only people who've ever thought about this, but I need them to stop. Don't do it.
They are not the only people. The Bluey subreddit has been full of this, and I'm like, wow.
So you're probably seeing the same thing.
The
like,
Bluey subreddit has got to be a gateway to something. I'm not sure what. It's a gateway to something.
To hell.
There was only one thing that could disrupt this, and that was somebody who the mods say they could verify was a Ludo employee being like, we've been done since 2021. It's done. It's over. And that post was up for 6 hours before that profile was scrubbed from Reddit, and now we're yelling about that in the Bluey Reddit.
Wow. I mean, wait, so are you now on team there's no more Blueys after this?
I was always on team there is no more Bluey. I think the show's done. I mean, I think
it
we'll
makes
get
eminent
something
sense
else,
to me that it's done.
But I think the TV show is over. I mean, we'll probably get like a movie or something. It's worth a lot of money. And yes, we'll probably get a theme park, I think, because again, it's worth a lot of money. But it seems like the TV show's done. It's been done for years. But yeah, that was
people saying that they're going to pick it up with like aging up the characters to be teenagers. It's like, I don't think the show works if they're 12.
I don't want a show about muffin and socks either.
I mean, okay. Well, I'm going to stop you right there, Katie, because
you want
to
show about muffin and socks?
This is the first time the idea is occurring to me that thanks to you presenting it to me, that there could be a show just called Muffin. And I would watch the shit out of that, because Muffin is far and away my favorite character on Bluey.
Which of your kids is more like Muffin?
I mean, at the moment, I guess Asa doesn't have a lot of competition because Ray still can't walk. But every
kid has their Muffin moment. I like to
I enjoy watching Muffin so much, but if I had to parent Muffin for 5 minutes, I would murder them.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, now here's a meme that has Chris Evans as Steve Rogers saying Bluey's kid is John Luke's features, and then Tony Stark saying Bluey's kid is Mackenzie's features, and then Civil War. So I guess it's still happening.
Yeah, I need everyone to chill the fuck out. This is a cartoon dog who's 7 years
so
old.
This is my wrap up question. This might be a can of worms if it is.
Oh boy,
we'll shut it down. But is like, where is the line between enjoying a show that's meant for kids and being way too into a show that's meant for kids?
Are we going back in the bronies era?
Do people need to is it not just calming down, but like get out of this, get away from Bluey? You've overinvested. What does it mean to overinvest, or is it possible?
I mean, is I think possible? He's overinvesting.
Is it possible to overinvest in a show like?
Certainly seems so.
I mean, I think it's as it is possible to like overinvest like. In anything, right? Like, I don't know that it being a kid's show makes it any different. Like, Bluey is as rich a text as anything, right?
Is it though? I mean, this last episode was wonderful. It was just like a perfect note for it to end on if it's over, which is,
I think,
hey, what's it like to have kids?
You know,
and
what?
I watch it and I just enjoy it. But then there's people out there who think it's a conspiracy theory.
Let me give a generous reading of what's happening here, which is Bluey, like so many cartoon shows, sort of creates this permanent childhood ideal, you know, where it's like they're going to be kids forever. You know, the same way they are in Phineas and Ferb, or the Simpsons kids have been the same age, obviously played by adults for more than 30 years. But the reality of making the show is that they can't be. And these are two forces at work that I think as parents we experience every day, where all we are trying to do is get our kids out of our hair, get them to sleep, get them to school. And then the second they are out of sight, we're sort of confronted with the reality that tomorrow they're going to be one day older, and they're not going to be this age forever. And we're going to have to mourn every iteration of our kids as we know them. And we'll have new versions of them to love. But the versions that we know of them today are going to be dead for all intents and purposes. And I think that sort of disconnect or that paradox is part of what's breaking adults' brains about Bluey, because they love this show. They love how sort of innocent and timeless it feels, and they hate don't know what to do with this feeling in a really concentrated way that it's ending right before their eyes, and there's only a very finite amount of it left potentially. And I think
they will get older too after it's over. I mean, if they can stay in the crystallis of this show, that they will not age, but if it ends, they will become older and march toward death.
That's the best I can do to get in the head of someone, you know, an adult who is on the Bluey Reddits.
I mean, I will tell you guys, you've not gotten to this point, but you will. I had a point where I had a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. I had a Bluey and a Bingo, and now I don't anymore. And I'm kind of sad about it. It's there. It's a real thing. Prepare yourselves.
You always have Bluey then.
I'll always have Bluey.
Shogun is a series that I should actually get out what it's saying. It's FX on Hulu is what it's still called. It's a good old FX on Hulu
show. Come on.
It's
actually, you can watch it on Disney Plus. So it's a FX on Hulu on Disney Plus.
You can watch it on Disney Plus in America?
Haven't you wondered why your Disney Plus account has gone from blue to teal?
No, I haven't.
The teal has the adult things.
The teal has the combination of Disney Plus Blue and Hulu Green.
Wow.
And when I learned this fact, I died. And you're actually talking to ghost me.
Wait, if I had watched a Disney Plus where I've not as gotten all the goddamn ads in the middle of Shogun, could I have spared myself of this?
Ooh, maybe.
That's possible.
I had no idea. Do you know how many people get beheaded on Shogun that it is on Disney Plus? I had no idea. A lot of people get beheaded.
Deadpool
Spoiler.
2 earlier on Disney Plus, so it's a place for violence now.
Wow, it used to be a thing that happened only in Europe. I'm sorry, I got
wait
track.
For the next season of Bluey. You'll see.
It's a 10 episode limited series that is an adaptation of the James Clavell novel. Similarly, there was a miniseries in 1980 where right when this was starting, I was digesting some of the, you know, historical takes of back in Shogun, but it got like moon landing numbers. Shogun, like people, like the attendance at restaurants went down on nights that Shogun was on, because people would be home
really?
Watching Shogun. Yeah, in the 1980s, in 1980 specifically, not in the 80s. Limited series. It was event television. Now it is just a pretty good television. This version is show run by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks. Justin Marks is one of the people who wrote Top Gun Maverick. Otherwise, I don't think I'm familiar with any of his
And the
other
Legend
work.
Of Chun-Li, Street Fighter, The Legend of
wow.
Chun-Li.
I'm not familiar with his other work.
I think he also wrote maybe The Jungle Book live action.
Yes, the quote-unquote live action Jungle Book was
He's done so. I think he is like a punch up guy. He's written a million scripts that have never gotten made. He is like a steady working screenwriter guy.
Oh, good.
He wrote a He-Man script.
Sure. Yeah. He's written. He's all over Deadline with like only a few actual credits.
Nice. So this one is he is producing with his wife, and they are adapting this book and have brought on Hiroyuki Sanada, who plays Lord Toranaga, the sort of one of the lead Japanese characters, on as an executive producer. And through the process, I haven't read the book, but I did watch the 1980 miniseries when I was in college. Wow. For lack of something else to do.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Wait, having just talked about how the hoops you jump through to watch things in college, how did you watch the 1980 miniseries Shogun in college?
It was in the library. Library had it. Wow. And I assume it was a VHS copy of it, but the lady would port it over to your screen like you would watch old documentary stuff in the library.
Wow.
And I spent some time in the library. Actually, it's probably the most time I spent in the NYU library is watching old TV shows. But yeah, so this one I
tuition just, money well spent.
Yeah, I definitely, you know. Why not? And then I met all of you guys sort of by happenstance, so I give NYU that credit. But yeah, this one is a slightly different focus than the 1980 series, because the book focuses on the character of John Blackthorne, who is played here by yet another person that looks like Tom Hardy, but it's not Tom Hardy, Cosmo Jarvis. And this one sort of expands it a little bit more to include a lot more of the characters from the Japanese side of the book, and a little bit more of a look at the dueling Catholicism and Protestantism that's happening behind the scenes. But I do think, having watched all 10 episodes now, the big takeaway is Anna Sawai, who plays Mariko.
Sawai.
And Sawai?
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool.
We all have a Matt Patchism within us.
Yes, I'm a whore. I'm actually rude. Worried about trying to talk about this series, because I'm going to have to say the character names out loud for the first time. Because usually you just watch 10 episodes, you know exactly who's who. But yeah, her as Mariko, great. What a year she's having, coming off of helping us battle Godzilla through the various stages of Earth.
She was in the Godzilla movie?
Yeah, she's in Monarch Legacy of Monsters.
Wait, Dave, say her last name, how you said it again.
Sawai?
Okay, we can edit this out. I'm looking at the katakana.
It's a Y, isn't it?
I'm looking at the katakana of how they spell it out on Wikipedia. It's like Sawai.
Oh. See? Dave wasn't so wrong.
I mean, either way, I was definitely wrong, and I shouldn't be, because she is great oscillating between the trash that was Monarch Legacy of Monsters. And I say that as a person who loved that trash.
Wait, was she in Monarch Legacy of Monsters and the Godzilla movie as like the same character? Are those things connected?
No, she wasn't in the movie.
She was just in the TV show. She was
just in the TV show.
All right. Listen,
Shogun. Shogun.
I get confused with the giant monsters. Okay, back
How
to
can you not keep the lore of post Godzilla 2014?
Because keeping track of Shogun and who was mad at who and who was plotting against who and what Toranaga's real plan was took all of my brain power and more. Mm. And so that's all I got left.
What Toranaga's real plan was is quite the question.
That is a good question. So yeah, it was, as Katie was alluding to, it sort of scratched that Game of Thrones itch for me, where I was expecting something a little bit more like the 1980 series, which is good, but was more about like production design and like having the audacity to do this on television. Now there are bits and pieces of that. There was a really good piece on The Ringer about how they used anamorphic lenses so that you get a lot of bokeh and even some vignettes on your screen, which apparently some TV watchers were not ready for how distinctly that looks like film and not like TV. And really, Patches, I know you didn't see it, but am I right in blaming things like Rebel Moon, Scargiver for us not expecting like lenses on fucking shit?
I think The Ringer did actually a huge breakdown of the anamorphic lensing on the show. I've seen the first episode of Shogun, and the one thing I can't get over, this is a total tangent here, but like, I'm losing my mind lately reading the resolution specs and the way that these all these shows like Andor, for instance, if you are into resolution and the difference between streaming versus what you would get from like a pristine 4K Blu-ray, go read about the differences of what you can buy from the Andor physical disc versus how it looks on Disney Plus or how Shogun must look on Hulu. It all looks like absolute shit. I can't believe how much we're settling for just shitty looking television.
It's shitification in every facet of modern life. But
it will make you so mad. But you may not even notice watching it at home.
Yeah, relative to how good it could have looked, I don't know. But I did think that Shogun looked pretty fucking good watching on Hulu.
Yeah, I enjoy just the take on this story. It is a wide story with a lot of characters. They ultimately, I think, came to a very moving conclusion that some have characterized sort of as an anticlimax, but I think it actually ends up being fine being through the series. I just think some fantastic character work was done here, and I sort of love how it didn't shy away from some things that we would traditionally have called difficult, but really I guess we would have traditionally called it difficult like pre-Game of Thrones.
What are you thinking of specifically?
There's some sudden and shocking violence sort of peppered throughout otherwise like pretty normal episodes, and there are very large swaths of the episodes that don't take place in English, even with the little trick that Portuguese sounds like English in this series. All the Japanese is, just there and just subtitled, and you have to read it, which is fine for me. It's fine for, Gen Z. I guess they watch TV with a lot of subtitles and closed captioning anyway. But
I feel like famously, or maybe millennials do this more, watch like with your phone out or like, that second screen experience, which is absolutely impossible for this show.
Absolutely. It was something that I couldn't second screen with. And it was something that I had a good time recovering from surgery with. I would just, get some food and sit down and do Shogun right before going to bed. So it sort of filled that spot, the prestige television spot, late night, catching up, watching something. Maybe not completely understanding what's happening in the episode until the episode is over, but that just shows a certain type of narrative complexity that I really ended up enjoying. I think I suckered some of you into watching it. Katie, what did you think about Shogun?
Yeah, I mean, that level of narrative complexity I thought was going to be the thing you were talking about that was difficult, because I certainly have not had an experience since the early seasons of Game of Thrones where at the end of every episode, I'm like, okay, I think I remember who everybody was in every scene, and I think I know what was implied when this guy looked at this guy, and then like...
Does that also cover House of the Dragon, a show that I could not understand
I got halfway through House of the Dragon, and okay. I imagine it was a similar experience. But like, I think that I'm up to date, and then all of a sudden someone's getting chopped in half by a cannon, and I'm like, what the fuck is happening? And like, why is that not resulting in a war? And like, these troops are coming, but whose troops are they? Like, the show is really beautiful, but there's like some wide shot CGIs of armies where I'm like, I don't know what's going on in any of this imagery. And maybe that's the intensification of the resolution. But the thing that is so powerful and that really kept me going is that character work that you're talking about. You've got these central characters of Toranaga and Blackthorn, the English sailor, and Mariko. But then this tapestry of people around them, like Yabushige as like the rogue who like, you never know which side he's going to land on. You never know who he's going to betray. And it's like the funniest person on the show. Fuji, who becomes Blackthorn's wife, kind of against her will, who stealthily emerges as like the best character on the entire show. Like there's one episode where you get your central love triangle plus Mariko's husband, who's like, spoiler alert, come back from the dead. And they're all having to live under the same roof and having history's worst dinner party, like stuff like that. That complexity pays off. Like all this time you spent being like, I don't know who that is. I don't know what the stakes are here. When you get there and you drill down and you realize the level at which they're operating, it makes it all worth it. And then you get to the final episode. And I think in the finale, once all the action is kind of done, you can get to the certain point where you're like, I know what that glance means. I know what's about to happen here. It kind of settles back down to a point where it leaves you in such a confident place. Not a lot of TV can pull that off. So it was kind of worth the... I honestly got to the end of every episode and listened to Joanna's recap podcast on the Prestige TV feed. And that is what got me through. And I highly recommend that to anyone who's confused by
just
Shogun.
To be like, did I really understand what I just saw? Let me make sure this podcast helps me with it.
Well, and in the finale specifically, there's like a flash forward, or is it a flash forward that I mm-hmm. didn't think that I had read correctly until I heard Joanna talk about it.
Wait,
and like,
is it not a flash forward?
I think it's a dream. This is the thing. Because he puts, we're spoiling Shogun, I think. Like, but we're just spoiling the
final episode. You should watch Shogun. Also, I think if you just say this, it's not
really...
Certainly
makes sense of the episode title.
Yes.
He throws her rosary in the water. And mm-hmm. so you see him holding it in that bed. So I think that it's not real. But
my
it's
problem, as you can tell from the question that I just asked, is that I tend to watch Shogun on half of an Ambien and a melatonin gummy at 12:30 in the morning after fighting my kids to bed for several hours. And the detail, it was not the show, not the show that was built for that. And some of the details clearly escaped me, but I wasn't going to miss this show for the world. I loved it. I'm eager to revisit it in a better state of mind and pick up now that I sort of understand the full scope of it and what to look for as we're really clued in on the final moments of the final episode about Torunaga's agenda and his character. Not as a person, I just mean like his traits, his virtue.
Well, but I think his character as a person becomes a question in that final episode. And like when you meet him in the first one.
His moral character is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, like you meet him in the first episode, you're like, oh, he's a Ned Stark kind of guy. He's like the one righteous person in this court full of backstabbers. And that gets complicated over and over again until in the final episode, it gets really complicated. And it's not going to leave you with anything simple there. And it does make you want to kind of rewatch with that knowledge to just keep an eye on him.
I do really commend the show because I think that modern audiences in large part because of Game of Thrones have been conditioned to see a show at the scale and expect a sort of massive battle of some kind to be the climax. And I don't think realized in the penultimate episode where there's an explosion in a castle and there's a prominent character dies that was sort of the pinnacle of the explosiveness literally mm-hmm. that you were going to get in the show. And you have a very subdued and meditative final episode. But, this is clearly never, I think certainly in hindsight, never a show about, war as we think of it. It was all, it was the kind of power games were subtle. They were all mental. They were all about sort of negotiation and loyalty and betrayal and, hiding, behind the, what is it? The Eightfold Fence.
The Eightfold Fence.
That is what the show has always been about. It's never been shy about being about it. I do think it's certainly no shame for having any sort of different expectation. But I think getting to the end of the show and seeing, in the clearest possible terms, the level at which it was operating and sort of what its real focus was, I think would mm-hmm. make a rewatch of this show particularly rewarding.
Yeah. Yep, I agree.
It's the sort of thing where it's like, I watch TV. I know what Chekhov's gun is. This is going to go somewhere. And it's like, not the type of show.
Nope, and then like the guns you don't see coming. Again, I'm still really stuck on the cannon and the chains and like who guy was who got blown up. And like multiple times someone would like open a box with a head in it and I'd be like, who? God. Whose head is that? And like, I don't think that's me. I mean, maybe me being a bad viewer, like I think I've been paying closer attention, but I do think it's meant for you to be one step behind it at all times.
Yeah, and it is going to be really rewatchable because it does give you context for everything by the end. But I would love to go back and figure out what I missed in like the first three episodes because a lot of people fleeing places that they may never come back to, and a lot of people establishing relationships that seem like they're going to be temporary that end up not being temporary. I definitely mm-hmm. was sort of like taking it as it came, and then by the end was like, oh, I would be interested in starting this again. Which I think is a high compliment to pay a television.
You
want to
go back and watch the first episode now that you know who Omi is, to go see what Omi's up to in the first episode.
Exactly. Good to see, I also ended up really caring about Fuji, but honestly, mm-hmm. until she became a consort, I didn't know what her deal was, but we definitely mm-hmm. saw her before. Yeah.
Has the most traumatizing fate of any TV character imaginable, in which she has to hand her baby over to be ritually sacrificed because her husband fucked up.
Yep, and sucks. I was like, this is a scene about the husband. It was not. It was a scene about Fuji. That's what you get on a rewatch of Shogun, I think. So, yeah, I'm very, very happy with how it wrapped up. I'm very glad we got it. I know there's some people being like, he wrote, four other books or whatever. I don't think we necessarily need Shogun. Let something really good be something really good. And let all of these people go back to Monarch Legacy of Monsters Season 2. Like
no.
They're supposed
well,
to.
Well, no, we like that show. Can I throw up my like semi-hot take? And I have not read the book Shogun. I didn't watch the 1980 series. But my understanding is that both of those are much more focused on like, this Englishman is in this strange exotic world, and through mm-hmm. his eyes, we will learn to understand this. And for many obvious reasons, they have de-emphasized that. But I wondered getting toward the end of it, and I think the finale resolves some of this, if by de-emphasizing his perspective, the perspective of Blackthorne, played by Jasmine Jarvis, you make that character less useful to the story. Because he's a pawn, very literally. Like, he's kind of being tossed between different lords for them to try to use to their own ends. His love story with Mariko, I think, is very moving, and all of that character stuff really works. But in terms of his role in the story, he doesn't really have a lot to do. And when he's not the kind of audience surrogate, I think he has even less to it. And I started wondering, until I think that the very end where it really landed, if that very necessary change made him kind of like a vestigial limb. Did you guys have this thought about Blackthorne at any point?
I think he's a catalyst that then loses his purpose. But then sort of like, now what I realize having seen the whole thing is the game is sort of keeping him sharp, even though he has like no purpose. Mm-hmm. So he's there and he keeps thinking he's doing something, but I don't think there was ever an intention to necessarily use him the way that it appeared he was being used.
You know, I think the way that the story considers his potential assimilation is sort of the opposite of something like The Last Samurai, where you have a character come in and he becomes sort of one with the Japanese and then their greatest warrior and their true hero. I mean, it's a white savior story, but I think the expectation that certainly Blackthorne brings to the story is that he is the main character. And I think the way that the show fucks with that idea until we get that wonderful, and I can't remember if we're in spoiler gone territory, but you get this wonderful kiss off in the final episode where Toranaga is just like, I was going to kill him, but I kept him alive, not because he was useful, because I thought he was funny. Mm-hmm. And like, that is like, he thinks that he is gaining as he learns Japanese and is, you know, developing romantic relationships with some of the local women, and potentially becoming a valuable ally technologically to Toranaga's war effort. I think even if he wants to go home, I think gets an inflated sense that's communicated to us in the way the story is being told of his impact in the story, the role that he has to play here. And at best, he's sort of a diversion. You know, he's like not even an ace up the sleeve. He's just like a wild card that Toranaga has that doesn't really factor into his plot. And I think, you know, when that does become a really helpful double blind for the story in terms of understanding what's actually happening here, where it isn't, you know, we're told time and time again that this conflict is unfolding by a very particular set of rules that are not going to be easily understood by outsiders. And it is our sort of Western narrative hubris to assume that we know exactly how things are going to play out and what's at stake, when even the Japanese characters are constantly, constantly telling us that Toranaga is craftier than we understand, and that we shouldn't trust, you know, his plan. And I don't even know what Operation Crimson Sky is. And like,
I
liked
all
the
parts where Yabushige is like, "Will you just tell me what the plan is?" And it's like, "Nope,
yeah. Nope."
So I was like, "Okay, good. He doesn't know either. All right, I'm just right."
And yeah, so like, there are so many layers of not knowing, and you know, I think the show sets a frequent trap where you can assume that you know too much, and that's sort of a death sentence. And I think that Blackthorne, who is an entertaining character, as amusing to us as he is to Toranaga, is effective on that score. Even if, you know, at the end of the day, this isn't ultimately his story. I would say this is sort of Toranaga's story.
Yeah,
in a way.
Sure.
Yeah, so
he's the shogun, as far as I know, from Japanese
he is.
History.
I mean, the closing title certainly makes that clear.
You know what's crazy is that much doubt. I watched Silence for the first time, like in the last couple of months, and which takes place about 30 years after the action of Shogun. So like, costumes, sets, like a lot of it looks very much the same because it's very similar period, but it's very different. Like, the way that Catholicism is incorporated into Japanese society is incredibly different. And so that was a real Wikipedia rabbit hole, is just to learn how all of that changed so quickly after the action, because the events of Shogun are fictional, but based very closely on real history.
Also, a phenomenal advertisement for immersive language learning. you know, that he is there for, I mean, I don't know exactly how long, but just by virtue of only being exposed to Japanese speakers, we're led to believe that he becomes like a, not fluent by any means, but that he's sort of like a functional Japanese speaker. And it's something I've been thinking about a lot watching Tokyo Vice, which is a distant sequel to Shogun, which I finally caught around to because I heard the second season was so excellent. I'd watched the pilot directed by Michael Mann, and then the Ansel Elgort of it all and everything else, the life getting in the way, just didn't really follow up. And man, I mean, that's another show set in Japan. The main character is a white foreigner. In this case, playing the first, and this is a true story based on a book that I read and enjoyed a number of years ago, based on the first foreigner hired to work in Japan's biggest newspaper as a beat reporter. In this case, he's working in the Vice section, and he gets mixed up with some Yakuza, and Ken Watanabe is a cop who he sort of allies with, and Rinko Kikuchi is his editor, and it is... it is not the kind of show that would ever opt for a really sort of subtle and introspective finale, I don't think. But it is riveting and a lot of fun. And I think every time I'm watching about Ansel Elgort doing his best to learn these lines phonetically at first and taking as many Japanese lessons as he could to get through it.
Shogun is on FX, on Hulu, on Disney Plus. If you want to check it out, limited series, it's pretty great. I imagine we'll be talking about it once we talk about the good television of 2024, but we'll see. I think
Emmy season wise you'll certainly be hearing about it plenty.
Yeah, Shogun. Patches, you gonna watch Shogun?
When life affords me time.
It's your Tokyo Vice.
Come watch my kids, and I'll watch all.
Your kids are gonna love Shogun. It's on Disney Plus. It's the same as Bluey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If your kids can figure out how to build a fucking tower in Tears of the Kingdom, they can figure out what's happening on Shogun.
I just don't think we're ready for the beheadings, and I don't want to explain seppuku to you, to my kids. Do you?
You see, when you dishonor yourself,
you're gonna learn about it either way.
My kid came home from school today, put on YouTube, and watched a stick figure video. It's like a bunch of stick figures running through a mad scientist obstacle course and just dying in a handful of incredibly violent ways and laughing hysterically. I mean,
he's ready for Shogun.
No, I mean, I think his trigger is so much more like losing. He hates losing, or like being frustrated, not knowing how something works. Violence makes no impact on him. Am I raising a monster? Time will tell.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week talking about Challengers.
Yeah!
Only a full 8 months after it was supposed to have premiered at the Venice Film Festival. Here it comes. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, executive editor over at Polygon.com. I am on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewyrm.com, where you can listen to old episodes of the show. If you are dying to hear more about the Rebel Moon franchise, go listen to our conversation about A Child of Fire from December, the hot episode. Fire, fightinginthewyrm.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm a film critic over at IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Bluey and Rebel Moon. Letterboxd, did I have a stroke? Hard to tell. You can find all of us together on the Apple Podcast app at Fighting in the War Room. Leave us a review. Do it. We haven't done it in a while, and I am bursting full of hot Marvel Snap goss that I'd be more than happy to tell you about.
Oh, there's goss in Marvel Snap? That's good to know.
Well, I mean, if you call my current infinite rank score goss, then yes.
I do.
But otherwise, we read it. Leave us a review. We'll read it live on the show, and if you don't have access to the American version of the Apple Podcast app, you can email us. Dave, where can they do that?
You can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, D-A-7-E, which is my handle on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd. I'm also on the Trial by Content podcast, where we're trying to figure out the best baseball movie ever. And man, democracy is a mystery to me with how some of these polls are turning out. But give them a listen. Trial by Content.
I'm Katie Rich. As of next week, you can find me at The Ankler. I'm going to be launching a newsletter and a podcast. I don't know when you'll see them for the first time. That's one of many things I get to learn. But I'm still here, and I'm on Twitter and Blue Sky at Katie Rich, and Instagram at Katie Rich Talking, and on Letterboxd, where I did show off my Letterboxd list of spoiler alert things that ended a surprise time jump, like that episode of Bluey. And like for a minute, I thought Shogun was going to do the same thing, but then it didn't. Anyway, feel free to send me contributions for that. You can also find us all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can recommend my other sources for learning about Japanese history, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Challengers in theaters this weekend, was cinema's previous best thruple energy?
Thanks for listening. We'll be back talking to you next week.
Bum, 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 bum. No, I'm done. We're done.